This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
And our guest tonight is Barrister Golriz Karaman. But first, my number of the week, which is 200. That is 200 environmental activists, wildlife rangers and Indigenous leaders trying to protect their land were killed in 2016, according to watchdog group Global Witness, and more than double the number killed 5 years ago. The research shows that, carried out by Global Research, that Global Witness, that environmental defenders have been killed at the rate of almost 4 weeks across the world. And the frequency of killings is only increasing as 2017 ticks by, according to data provided exclusively to the Guardian newspaper, with 98 killings identified in the first 5 months of this year alone. So John Knox, a UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and the Environment, said human rights are being jettisoned as a culture of impunity is developing. He further said that there is now an overwhelming incentive to wreck the environment for economic reasons. The people most at risk are people who are already marginalised and excluded from politics and judicial redress and are dependent on the environment. The countries do not respect the rule of law. Everywhere in the world, defenders are facing threats. There's an epidemic now, a culture of impunity, a sense that anyone can kill environmental defenders without repercussions. Which eliminate anyone who stands in the way. And it comes from mining, agribusiness, illegal logging and dam building. So, for example, in the Mexican Indigenous leader and opponent of illegal logging, Isidro Baldenegro Lopez, was killed in January this year. And in May, farmers in Brazil's Maranhão state attacked an Indigenous settlement, hacking with machetes people's hands and in a land conflict that left more than a dozen in hospital. And there's been killings of environmental defenders and attacks on others in Colombia, Honduras, Mexico and many other countries since the new year. So most environmental defenders die in remote forests or villages affected by mining, dams, illegal logging and agribusiness. And many of the killers are reportedly hired by corporations or state forces. And very few were ever arrested or identified. So the Guardian newspaper is actually launching a project in collaboration with Global Witness to attempt to record the deaths of everyone who dies over the next year in defence of the environment. So that's my terrible and really tragic number of the week, because we've been talking about this before. I've talked about this on a few other programmes in the last few years, the number of people who have been killed, and this has been a tragic upturn in the number of killings. So that's 200 environmental campaigners and wildlife rangers who were defending the environment were killed last year in 2016, and it looks like we're going to have more next year.
It's not a cheery thing to start with, though, Shane.
It isn't, and often, this is the thing about the numbers I come up with, they're often not very cheery. I do try and find some ones that are more happy, but unfortunately it's not. There's not that many. It's a sad story we're telling here.
Is there a silver cloud anywhere?
There are. We are, in fact, increasing our renewable energy resources, as I mentioned a few weeks ago. And so our solar panel installations have been increased, I think, last year by the greatest amount that's ever increased. So we are starting to see a leveling of global carbon emissions. We're starting to see some really, really positive moves across the globe in limiting the amount of carbon emissions we have. But we have such a long way to go, and it's not decreasing fast enough. But there are some good signs. There are some positive numbers out there. They're few and far between.
But specifically about the death of environmental activists, are there any, like, chinks of light?
Well, I think that the United Nations is now putting some effort and looking at the issues. We can start putting real pressure on governments to act on human rights abuses, because the United Nations is one of the few things, and we can actually talk about this later with Golriz, because she's some experience in this matter, that we can actually start putting pressure on the governments and start acting to protect environmental activists around the world. Because often these, like I said in the report, these people are often marginalized indigenous peoples who are trying to protect their land from agribusiness and from people with basically a lot of money and corporations, and we can start putting pressure on those. And with the United Nations now giving some thought to it, there is some light, but we just need to know about it, and people need to start campaigning around it to protect these people who are doing this good work on the environment. So, Sam, do you have a thought for the week? Something probably
I've
a lot
something
less depressing.
Cheery.
You've got something cheery. I have something depressing. You've got something cheery.
Remember when we interviewed Bob Huish from somewhere in Canada and talked about his course within their degree?
That was Dalhousie University, yes.
Yep. Talking, essentially teaching people how to be activists.
Mm-hmm.
And we said in passing, wouldn't it be a good idea if we had a degree in that?
Yes, we did.
We've sent it off for accreditation this week.
Yay!
Because the Polytech can move on such things
a bit more quickly than the university.
So it's gone off. It is 300 and something pages, because it's an interesting degree. It doesn't fit any of the normal measures that we assess degrees by. So in almost every single case, we're saying, is it A or B? And we're saying, well, actually, it's C, and have to explain why what we're doing. So it's still at the moment called the Bachelor's of Making a Difference.
BMAD.
With a BMAD, because of that acronym, and for some other reasons, I'm pretty sure we're not going to get away with calling it that, but it's what it's going in as, although we're putting a star on it to say that if anyone can come up with a better name, we're open to that. We're not going to...
I think BMAD's good.
We like it too. We like that idea that it is actually about acknowledging that people want to make a difference. So it is all about making a difference in communities, organizations, whatever, in a whole range of roles that might not have been thought of yet, or are hybrids of existing jobs. And it's explicitly for people that want to be change makers. So an alternatively name for it, actually, that we're exploring is Bachelor of Leadership for Change. Another one that people quite like, despite the fact that it's tautologist, is Transformational Change. Bachelor of Transformational Change. So it's looking at all those sorts mm-hmm. of words. So it's going to be highly personalised, almost entirely project-based, and getting people to actually in making a difference from the outset of the degree. The trick is that we're preparing people for jobs that don't exist yet in 3 years' time, they need to find something to do. And, of course, it might not be what we could traditionally think of as employment. All of the indicators are suggesting that an awful lot of the people that are graduating and entering the workforce now aren't going to be working for large corporations and stay working in those jobs their whole careers. So we are preparing people very much in the model of that they're managing their own careers. So it's for people that want more than a job, for big thinkers that want to create meaningful change.
That's great. And I actually read some of the feedback you got from the Qualifications Authority, and it was incredible. They were really, really so positive. I was really, really blown away with the fact that they've been so open to this new and exciting idea.
We're getting there,
exactly.
There's still a few hurdles to go. We've got a big panel visit probably in November, but it's on the way.
Fantastic, great. So we're going to go on to our guest for tonight, is Golriz Garaman. Golriz was a United Nations consultant in international human rights law, justice at the United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime. She's a barrister and special counsel in international human rights, criminal justice and constitutional law. Is a policy coordinator for Action for Youth and Children Aotearoa, and was an assistant prosecutor for the United Nations Assistance Mission for the Khmer Rouge Tribunal in Cambodia. You've also worked at The Hague and in Africa. And you graduated from Auckland with a double degree in law and history and did a master's in human rights law at the University of Oxford. Angora was ranked number 10 on the Green Party list, and Auckland to Plan will be entering New Zealand Parliament on the 24th of September of this year as the first ever refugee to enter New Zealand Parliament as a Green MP. Welcome to our show. And I've only just given you a very brief summary, because I was going through your CV there, and I was just going, what? How have you done so much so early in your career?
I'm not that young. I am 35. Law school finishes when you're about 22. So I just did stuff the whole time. But it always fascinates me when people read out or do a selective summary of my CV because of the way they kind of put it together. So I am a UN consultant currently for the Office of Drugs and Crime, but, you know, historically I prosecuted for the UN, but I also defended. And no one ever says that. It's so fascinating to me. No one ever says, you know, was defence lawyer and then, and you know, also prosecutor. It's always former UN prosecutor. And it kind of reminded me of when I would go off to go and do, you know, my UN work in Tanzania or in The Hague. And, you know, I'd always have get-togethers with friends and everyone would go, good luck. And I'd go, I'm defending. And they'd go, oh, bad luck. Really break a leg.
Lose.
But anyway, yes, that seems like a lot when you read it out.
It is, yes. So tell me about your childhood, because you have a very interesting story to tell us.
Yeah. I was born... Essentially, I kind of think, now that I've had to think about it a lot recently telling this story, that my life probably began with a revolution, which was the Islamic Revolution, sort of the big bad brother of the Arab Spring that happened in 1979. I wasn't born until 1981, but it kind of shaped everything because it was this popular revolution and my parents were involved in it. Everyone was involved in it. Essentially students, you know, socialists, Islamists, people who just wanted the oil resource nationalized, and they, you know, fought to overthrow this monarchy and pretty repressive regime, at least politically, although it was at least secular. And then sort of they don't seem to ever know what mechanism was used against them, but the revolution was hijacked by a very, very conservative Islamic regime, and which is in power still to this day, and it's probably one of the most repressive regimes, religious or otherwise, in modern times. Yeah, so I was kind of born into that with all sorts of things like phone tapping and people sort of disappearing and music being outlawed, and that was just the backdrop to... a very bloody war that was being waged with Saddam Hussein's Iraq, and then sanctions that came as a result of that. We found out later that America had been selling weapons to both sides, but at the time we were the baddies, and you know, and Saddam Hussein was being backed. So scarcity essentially set in, and you know, we were running out of food and medicine and even oil. You know, we had to use coupons and line up to use. And everyone seemed to be trying to escape, which we couldn't sort of do, but we did eventually and arrived here in sort of Auckland and made it to safe ground and sort of made ourselves known as refugees and were welcomed happily. But recently someone for an article asked me for childhood photos, and I was looking at them and I realised that... I never sort of point this out, but actually I sort of had a very happy childhood as well. You know, people were still having birthday parties and, and like, kindy, you know, kindy plays and stuff, because that's all our photos are. So certainly there's all of that normal joy and normal sort of childhood stuff as well in the Middle East. Yeah.
So you arrived in New Zealand. So what was it like arriving here? Was it kind of they're very different countries and very different climates.
Yeah.
Or was it something that you just took in your stride as a child? Or
yeah, I think I did. And I think culturally it wasn't, of course it was different, but it wasn't that different in the sense that, Iran was only, it was the first decade of post-revolutionary Iran. So very much still in sort of living memory of my parents' generation, at least, was the secular, relatively free culture that wasn't very religious or whatever else. Of course, the base of it has always been Islamic. But, so it wasn't, you know, the kind of the sort of interactions between men and women and all of that stuff was completely normal within our sort of community, at least, in Iran. And so that was all fine. But there was little things like people not wearing shoes and you know, like,
all
of that stuff where we were sort of fascinated and sort of, but it was what was really nice. And we moved to West Auckland, which I'm happily running in as a candidate now, even though I haven't lived there for years. But we lived in West Auckland, and it sort of didn't matter that we didn't have anything and that we were a bit different. And, you know, it was diverse, and it was socioeconomically diverse. And, you know, there was this kind of can-do attitude that comes with Kiwi culture that we that really helped us, you know. So, I really appreciated that.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
I recently found a letter from myself to myself. So I have the exact answer to that.
Oh, wow.
I forgot to open it at the right time, but I opened it recently. And so 14-year-old me at least wanted to be Lois Lane. So be investigative journalist who travels around the world busting stories wide open. I thought that wasn't too bad.
That was pretty accurate, though. I mean, you didn't go too far off that.
We didn't go too far, No, I didn't. Yeah, didn't quite make it to journalism, but, yeah, it was all right.
So what happened to that?
I just didn't open the letter. No, I think...
What am I going to do? I don't know. I wish I got a letter.
No, I think you're right, Shane. I don't think I strayed too far away from it. I think it was... The thing that really appealed to me about Lois Lane is that she... you know, she did that, like, it was all anti-corruption stuff, you know, it was all kind of...
And Superman,
and interestingly, the rest of the letter, like, the first bit of the letter was really, like, this feminist sort of declaration of, you know, just be this truth to power, you know, independent woman, and then the rest of it was, like, types of guys to date. It was, like, literally just, like, physical descriptions. So that was not... the greatest.
Why do you think you wanted to be an investigative journalist? What was it you... Did you have something that you'd, like, seen or wanted to investigate?
I think it was literally, and that's probably still at the base of what I do, it was literally that standing up to the great big might of, you know, whether it's a... And I don't think I articulated that properly probably at that age, but it was that thing that she did where it was like, but there's this very powerful big corporation or Lex Luthor or whatever, and you kind of chip away at it, and you don't take no for an answer, and you... you bust the story and you bring down the bad guys, even though you're just one woman. So, that is what I quite... And she was very independent. She sort of didn't really, even though there was Clark Kent and Superman, I think she was his boss. I feel like, you know, they are... it's quite a bit better than the Batman story where you get Bruce Wayne, this, like, millionaire sort of philanderer. So there's a feminist story in the Superman comics.
So you took yourself off to do law school instead?
Well, I actually studied history, and I did sort of modern history, gender and sex studies. We were just talking about this earlier, actually, where on my sort of degree, I only found this out when I asked for references to go to Oxford, and the head of the history department put down my major as sex. I was like, oh God, thanks Barry. That's going off to Oxford. So it was sort of sex and gender studies, and I didn't have any interest in practicing law, although I kind of did it as a sensible thing.
To keep the parents happy
kind of thing. And especially in Auckland Law School at the time, there wasn't much diversity in the papers you could do. It was really, you know, we're feeding the corporate law firms in the city, and that's our focus. So I think other law schools might be a bit different. But, you know, you couldn't even study human rights, or there wasn't a paper, not a single paper in anything. Sort of it was international law and nothing else that was vaguely interesting to me. So I came out of that interested in human rights and went to work for Amnesty International, and very quickly realised it was during the Zawi case when they were holding Ahmed Zawi without charge or trial. And I realised really quickly that I don't really know how to be a lawyer, and therefore I don't really know how to enforce human rights, and that's maybe what they need rather than just someone who's interested in, you know, like, it's not about me and my... sort of dinner party conversation about how I'm doing human rights. It's sort of, you need to go and be effective. So I went to become a barrister sort of in a roundabout way that way, because I realised I need to know how to be in court. And actually, you know, it's really useful to have a law degree, but you don't know how to be that thing. You don't know how to be a lawyer. And criminal law, to me, is sort of, and I think it truly is, one of the purest forms of human rights law. You know, you're really standing between the mighty force of the state and very marginalised people often. And whether or not, you know, they're guilty, you're still making sure that there's a process whereby people are not being arbitrarily detained or arrested or searched. Police powers are in check. You know, there's no discrimination. Even though we don't always succeed, there is this process. And I think being part of that every day, you know, and we don't, I often think people should go into the criminal courts and just look, you know. We've got these great addresses being made, you know, by our great orators. We've got all sorts of people coming through, all sorts of incredible human stories being told, and all these power dynamics. So that's where my passion for the law came from, essentially.
So what was it like going to Oxford from Auckland? Because it's quite... Oxford, you know, yeah. I don't know. I've been to Cambridge, but...
The other place.
The other place, you know. Because I was in Edinburgh, which is Edinburgh University, which is called, like, the Cambridge or the Oxford or Oxbridge of the North. But, you know, the special, very special culture is there, and quite different from Auckland. So what was it like going there? And
I kicked up a fuss about the prayers before meals and made them stop.
Oh, excellent.
They reinstated them after I left. but, yeah, it was an interesting degree in the sense that the Human Rights Law Masters is a master's degree for professionals who are practicing in human rights law in some way. So you have to prove that before being considered for the degree. So in fact, what it is made of is this incredible bunch of people who are based all over the world. So my cohort were, you know, people based in Gaza and Iraq, the first ever Attorney General for the state of Texas who was openly gay, you know, like who had to like leave the course to be sworn in by Obama.
Wow.
Like, just so cool. And you get, you know, these incredible lecturers come in because it's a professional degree. So you get like the special rapporteurs come in from all sorts of places just to do special lectures and then leave. So in that sense, it wasn't very Oxford. You know, it wasn't just a bunch of very privileged people sitting around sort of reading books and punting. But but it was still Oxford. And I don't know, I loved it. It was a window into a world that I hadn't really experienced before. And I often think maybe, again, I have the sort of diverse environment of West Auckland to thank for the confidence that I had. And actually, maybe Auckland Girls Grammar, where I went, which is one of the most diverse schools in the country, where you kind of get the confidence to sit down in an exam room at Oxford as a, you know, child asylum seeker from a tiny island in the middle of the South Pacific, you know. I didn't pay attention to the status stuff. I don't have much respect for status in itself, so so that helped.
So what did you do after that? So you got your master's, and so what happened after that? That was...
I actually deferred Oxford at first because I got my first job at the Rwanda Tribunal. So actually, right, it went around the other way. I was practicing as a junior barrister here, and I saw that international criminal law was suddenly being offered at Auckland. And so I sort of negotiated with my boss to go and do this one paper. And the lecturer of that paper was really impressed that, you know, someone that didn't need to was coming to his lectures. And I was a defence lawyer, and he had defence law practice. And again, you know, it's really unusual for defence people to be interested in this thing that's very high morals, you know, we're catching the bad guys. So he was meeting with a defence lawyer from the Rwanda Tribunal who was in New Zealand interviewing witnesses. We've got a Rwandan community here that I think most people don't realise. And so he said, oh, you know, you should come out and have dinner with us. And I did. And it, again, you know, this guy was sort of like, oh my God, you're a practicing lawyer and you're interested in international criminal law. It's, you know, most people that we get are just like PhDs or UN human rights lawyers, and they don't know how to run trials, and we're just really desperate for people. You know, it's not a weird sort of very intellectual field. It is a trial, but we're getting treated like, you know, it's this very, very high intellectual academic field of law. I mean, it is intellectual probably, but it's not the most academic. It's very practical. So come, you know, please, if you can kind of fund it, come out and we'll sort something out, essentially. Wow. So I went off to Africa and with no real job, and I got a job. And then I deferred Oxford.
So what was that experience like?
It was incredible. It was, well, two things. Again, being sort of cynical, I already knew that the defence weren't going to get too much by way. You know, the trials weren't going to be particularly fair per se, so I was coming in as a cynic. And, you know, you'd be horrified, but it literally is like the prosecution and the judges and all of that are sort of separate, and they have access to each other's floors and the building, and in a very sort of physical sense are part of the establishment, and the defence floor is completely naked. You know, you have to bring your own paper for the photocopier, and yeah, like it's completely, so you just get an hourly rate from the UN, but you get no facilities, for example, and you know, it's very much assumed that we already know who's guilty, and you know, it's just, you know, we're doing this trial because we have to do a trial, and and it's very slow, and you know, it has to be translated into three languages, and so you'd be surprised at how inefficient and actually underfunded some of those UN tribunals are. So there is all of that, and you're just inside of this big machine. It's not necessarily, you know, you don't feel like you're changing the world immediately, or that you're involved in something very exciting per se. But then you look out and you are in Africa. So that is very exciting and interesting. And, you know, in Arusha, where the court is based, is this town that's like dead between the great mountains of Africa, Kilimanjaro and Mount Meru, where people come to have like these amazing climbing experiences of a lifetime, and the Serengeti. So where people are coming to have, wow, you know, the birthplace of civilization, you know, or humanity, and, you know, the animals and the Great Five and all of that stuff. So you get to, like, on weekends, be on safari looking at rare rhinos and, wow, and then do a little climb to one of the lower summits or whatever. And so that was absolutely incredible.
How did that not do your head in doing that at the weekend and then going and being part of a horrific retelling?
I mean, people often sort of go, oh, how is it not stressful for you to look at sort of terrible, you know, be living this terrible context all the time? But I think I find it so satisfying to be bringing order and justice to something I already know happened. You know, it's humanity, and crime and deviancy are sort of part of it. And for me, again, I've already lived it. Like, I've already been in a war. So to be kind of sitting here, I just got really antsy, I think, sitting in relative peace, you know, knowing that all of this other stuff was happening and, you know, like I could contribute in some way and be involved with it. And it's much more calming to me to be involved in something, even if it's confrontational, than to know that it's happened and sort of ignore it. So it was, if that makes sense, it was kind of, you're still bringing order to it. You're experiencing it from a totally different vantage point, in the sense that you're involved with conflict resolution rather than the actual conflict. So it's satisfying in that sense. But the thing that is upsetting and distressing, I think, is living in a society where there's so much poverty, so much inequality, and you're going to court, you know, with multi-million dollar trials are being held, even though there's no paper in the photocopier on the defence floor. And that is really confronting, because you're not involved with solving that. You're just living it. And there's very violent crime, you know, even though Arusha is in relative peace for Africa and, you know, all of that stuff. There's not not an armed conflict, but there's very violent crime happening and you're unsafe and you have to go home immediately when, you know, it's dark. And so that was confronting. I found that stressful, and I wouldn't live there, for example.
But you've repeated that experience, because you would have had the same experience, similar experience in Cambodia.
Cambodia was distressing for the poverty, but at least it was safe. Like, you felt like you could be part of the community. You could at least interact with your, you know, you could settle and you could try and help, or you could kind of be part of the humanity of, you know, the other side of life there. But I did find that eventually I had to leave because I couldn't really be an expat forever in that sense. And then The Hague I found distressing in another way because it was separate. It was so far removed from what we were doing. So you weren't in the community. You know, you didn't really have a connection with the Bosnian or the Yugoslav community at all, and you weren't, like, in that context at all. You're just getting, you know, you were just in this very cushy, very calm Dutch town, which is so scenic. But I think Cambodia, I was kind of done, and I was remembering as you're talking, Shane, I lived there when Chuck Whitty, who's a very high profile environmentalist, was shot dead, and he was trying to show some journalists some illegal logging that was happening in one of the forests, and recently, I think there's a British documentary that came out a year or so ago, I Am Chuck Whitty, and that's been banned, you know, in Cambodia. And so when, you know, when the land struggles started and the sort of labour disputes and things like that kind of started to happen, and you kind of start to really remember you're driving past the factories every day and then people are getting shot.
So you've seen three, you know, Rwanda, Cambodia, the Khmer Rouge, and then with the concentration camps and the massacres in former Yugoslavia. Those are, you know, three terrible events. What did you see any common? What were the common elements to those? What allows people to do that to other people, or did you see anything common, or is it just each situation is unique?
Each situation is unique, but each situation begins with dehumanizing a group, you know. So somebody decides, or a group of people decide, that for political gain it's all right to stereotype, to then dehumanize, then to legally disenfranchise a group as a group based on their ethnicity or their religion or whatever it is. In Cambodia, it was a class war, but, you know, and when that starts to happen, it has to be stopped or it won't really end well. And it's often both sides, but sometimes it's just the weaker side being, you know, treated a certain way. So when you see something like the rhetoric that Donald Trump is kind of using at the moment, it trigger, you know, for me, it's like, you know, because I've had to read those speeches over and over again, and not to say that he's going to, you know, commit mass atrocity, but it's the rhetoric that's undermining of human rights.
Yeah, because you saw that with Brexit. It was as soon as the Brexit referendum came through, there was a sudden upspike in the UK of race tax and tax
exactly
on ethnic minorities. And, you know, having been kind of experienced that in the UK myself, being Irish, you kind of understand how the system kind of like picks on you and how you can be marginalised really, really easily. So do you find it now upsetting, or like you see those echoes and these Brexit movements and Trump?
Yeah, I definitely see it as, for lack of a better phrase, a call to arms for those of us who, you know, do want to kind of protect that sort of rights-based framework, to kind of start using the language of inclusion, to start claiming back nationalism, you know, start claiming back what it means to be, whether it's English or Kiwi or whatever it is, American, you know, as something that is about equality and justice and diversity or inclusion, you know, that kind of rhetoric of Justin Trudeau, you know, our diversity is our strength, which he throws around really liberally as a counterpoint to Trump, and he's been really successful with that. Or, you know, the Austrian Greens really concertedly sort of reclaimed what it means to be Austrian to counter the sort of neo-Nazi movement, and they did it really well. So you've got to kind of give people a place to go, but you can't let it go. You can't sort of go, oh, you know, it's just talk. because, you know, there's that age-old thing of, like, first they came for the communists and I didn't say anything because I'm not a communist. Yeah, it's just kind of like, no, you've really got to stand up for something at this point.
So now your list of things that you're doing that Shane skimmed through, and you made the point that you it's been a while since you left law school, but that doesn't explain how many hours there are in a day. So what drives you to be so passionate about all of these different boards and these different causes you get involved in and so on?
Yeah. I'll do your degree. It's about that stuff. It's like it takes over, I think. You kind of put your hand up because you're interested in something, and then the next minute someone's like, oh, well, you should be on our board. And then you've got meetings, you know, four nights a week, and you're kind of kicking yourself. But I always stop and go, well, where would I be if I wasn't in this meeting among these people who are fighting for children's rights or just talking about children's rights or whatever, and I would probably be trying to be at that meeting. So, you know, it's actually not really work. It keeps me really connected. And I think I definitely tried hard to get connected when I first moved back to New Zealand. Because whilst I was really over that kind of psychological pressure of being an expat, because you are in these contexts where, you know, the poverty doesn't make sense and your work isn't necessarily as fulfilling as you thought because it's a mad machine, the UN. But, you know, I really did like being among people who, even if half of them were disconnected and just wanting to sort of be UN employees, the other half were there for a reason and they'd been doing things and been passionate about what they do and choosing different lifestyles like me, and that was stimulating to me. So when I came back, I was afraid that I was going to get swallowed whole by this kind of, especially Auckland, culture of, like, just talking about house prices and, and, you know, the latest gadget or whatever else. And I know that sometimes in New Zealand we can be really apathetic and disconnected from issues and, you know, you can't talk politics at the table and all that. So I really decided to get really super active again and sit on committees and things just to have my people around me, like just to have people. And that, you know, the Greens really gave me that as well when I came back. So it was nice to be around people that are politically active, for example.
So you talk about you're on sitting in a couple of boards, the child, what's that called?
It's Children and Youth Aotearoa.
That's right. So
he can't read his own typing.
I can't, no. I missed it there on the old paragraph. But we had we have some pretty shocking statistics here in New Zealand. I mean,
we've got no statistics. The shocking thing is they don't keep them.
Well, exactly.
That's a breach. It's a human rights breach.
And not only that, I mean, because we got briefed at the university that we're going to have to be expecting a huge number of children, you know, our young people, our young students coming through with mental health issues. And we actually have the highest youth suicide rate in the OECD. What's your handle on that? Why do you think this is happening? What's going on?
Well, I think systematically state services have been defunded. At one point, I don't know how accurate this is necessarily, but someone at the Human Rights Commission, when they were despairing, it was after this, I think it was in the middle of the second term, of the national government, and we're talking, and he kind of went, you know, they've defunded the sort of equivalent of about a government department per year, and, you know, in order to get, and, you know, government departments are big and small, so they're not, I don't know how massive that would have been, but it's services that are coming out of the community. But I think the other thing that is really worrying to me is just the idea of state services is gone. Like, we don't even use those terms anymore. There's no state housing, it's sort of social housing. Mm. And it's, so this idea, which comes from human rights law and the human rights framework, which is that we have rights, we have agency, because we are human and we live here, not because of some moral, you know, high ground that we have to achieve or some other form of success, because we're humans. And the government have obligations. Their mandate to govern comes from their ability to provide us with these rights, to meet, you know, these basic levels of healthcare, whether it's mental health, whether it's housing, whether it's, and, you know, suicide is just the end point of a whole lot of things that have gone wrong. You know, we don't have sex ed in schools that are standardised, and we don't have, you know, like, yeah. we don't have access to sort of that type of healthcare either. And for girls, at least, a lot of that comes from, you know, we've also got one of the highest rates. It's gone down a little bit in recent years, but of teen pregnancy. And, you know, those types of things are all connected, and we've got really low sort of employment and young people being engaged in sort of professional training rates as well, because it doesn't exist in most of the provinces. So, you know, we just need to invest.
If we work on the assumption that you will get into Parliament, what is it you want to do?
I want to bring a human rights framework to our law and policy making, and I kind of got sick of waiting for people with that kind of expertise to be in our House of Representatives. And, you know, there's all these incredible people working in the NGO and sector and the commissions, and they're all getting defunded over time, and, you know, their independence is being undermined. And one of the things that really troubled me when I first came back was the way that democracy was, you know, our institutions of democracy were being undermined, and the way that they, you know, they were treated as with sort of disdain. So, you know, urgency processes of Parliament being used repeatedly to sort of cut people off from whether it was the courts or the Human Rights Act, as in the family carers case, which is one of my cases. Now, you know, the parents or family members of profoundly disabled persons who just wanted to get paid, you know, what we're asking for now is minimum wage at full time, and knowing that if they put their loved one into care, the state will pay a private company about $70,000 a year, which is much, much more than minimum wage at full time. And that obligation exists, but they won't pay the family carers, and the courts and the Human Rights Tribunal found repeatedly that there was discrimination, and that's unlawful in New Zealand on family relationship grounds. And, you know, the government repeatedly appealed it, and when they lost, finally, you know, in the Court of Appeal, instead of doing the right thing, they passed legislation under urgency to not only cut off the family carers from the precedent value of those cases, but from the human rights remedies regime altogether.
But isn't that an insult on the constitution of the country?
Well, we don't have one. We don't protect the Human Rights Act and the Bill of Rights Act in a superior law kind of way like other nations do. So Parliament can pass any type of legislation that, if as long as it expressly breaches the Human Rights Act or the Bill of Rights Act, it's okay.
Because we're one of the few countries on the planet that doesn't have a constitution.
I mean, we have a constitution in the sense that these documents, you know, the Treaty of Waitangi, the Human Rights Act, the Bill of Rights Act, do form, and, you know, we've got electoral laws and things, do form our constitution, but we don't have a what's called a superior law constitution, where the court can strike down legislation based on a breach of our constitution. Or that, you know, if Parliament does want to change something like our access to the Human Rights Tribunal or Act, that it would have to use a supermajority to do it, so that any old sort of Peter Dunn vote government can't just cut you off from the Human Rights Act. That's something that goes beyond just this Parliament. And what we learnt with something like the family carers case, as with some of the other urgency type legislation that's been passed, is that that separation between the courts that, you know, allow a citizen to actually, you know, assert their rights, and Parliament, and then the executive, that separation of powers was just sort of being upheld by some gentleman's agreement. You know, we don't have that protection. And parliaments haven't previously been willing to specifically say, you know, that court case no longer has application, or that this type of person can no longer access the Human Rights Act, which they did. Family members caring for their disabled loved ones have no access to the discrimination regime of the Human Rights Act under urgency, which means no consultation.
So introducing a human rights framework seems so sensible to us, of course. And it presumably it has seemed sensible to people like you and us for some time. So why hasn't it happened? Is it inertia or is there vested interests stopping it happening?
I mean, we have a human rights framework. It's just that I want that expertise in Parliament, and I want expertise, you know, when we did the child rights work, we realised policymakers don't really know that the child rights framework exists, for example. So it was like an education, like start at the bottom thing, which was great. We, you know, we did a bit of work on that. So it's about having like our actual lawmakers have knowledge of pre-existing expertise in human rights law and kind of introducing that. I mean, what I would like is if we do start a constitution conversation in New Zealand, but I think as a starting point, it would be good to bring the vantage point of human rights law to Parliament. So, you know, start thinking of our people as being bearers of rights.
And how, I mean, going into Parliament, you know, being in the opposition can be quite frustrating. Are you obviously
not for a defence lawyer?
No, defence lawyer. But I mean, how are you going to manage that? You know, this maybe lone voice in Parliament arguing these points. I mean, is it, you know? I mean, you seem to me to be the kind of person who gets out there and does things. And you know, what's it going to be like in Parliament for you?
Well, I've already had this experience of working in giant, slow-moving machines, so I'm certainly not going in with rose-coloured glasses thinking, you know, we're going to change the world immediately on the first sitting. And I do think it's a collaboration, and I think, you know, the Greens have sort of shown that in terms of working with even National. People forget that we had a memorandum of understanding with National on the one issue of, you know, insulation, for example, and we got that done. And so, you know, it's about working across the board as long as the policies and values match ours. And so I don't think, you know, I don't think I'm going to go in with any kind of really hard partisanship, but our values are going to be really strongly held. So we, you know, you just chip away at it. And it's about changing the culture of these things as well, you know. And I think, you know, just as I've had to get my head around this a little bit, you know, in terms of what does it mean to be, you know, the first refugee in Parliament or, you know, a Middle Eastern woman or, you know, whatever. And I've kind of gotten to a point where I've stopped fighting it because, and I had to do that a couple of years ago when they first started asking me to be involved in activism to do with the refugee crisis. And I thought actually, like, my fear of tokenism is actually less important than these people dying in the Mediterranean. So I've realised that actually, I've come to a point where I think being at the table, like my face will mean different things to different people, but you slowly are actually changing something that's in the culture. So even talking about human rights in our House of Representatives will have an effect. And, you know, the small wins matter too.
So, yeah, because you partially answered the question I'm about to ask you, which is what actually made you decide to stand? I mean, that was, you know, because putting yourself out, especially as a woman, you know, from refugee, you're a racial minority here in this country, you know, you're putting yourself out there in an environment which is quite aggressive and unpleasant at times. I've seen some people tweeting and saying nice, terrible things on social media.
Yeah,
that must have been. You must have known that was going to happen. And what process goes through your head when you say, okay, I'm going to go do this?
Yeah, I don't think I thought about the attacks per se. Although I was far less surprised than the people around me were. But yeah, I think what I did was essentially I decided that. Especially in the global context now, to have human rights law expertise in Parliament and to have diversity in our House of Representatives is urgent. And I've been talking about it for a while, and it was actually my partner who sort of said, you've just got to be that person. Sometimes you have to, you know, you can't keep saying, I wish, you know, this and that. You have to stand and do it. Yeah, so I did, and he was right. I think we all have to think that actually, you know, from time to time, and I think maybe as women we don't do it as much, and maybe as minorities we don't do it as much. But then when I got the barrage, like the absolute, you know, sometimes gut-wrenching barrage of attack on social media, and, you know, I was getting it from on every platform. It was like people who hate immigrants, people who hate refugees, people who hate Muslims, people who, and I'm not a practicing Muslim, But of course, that was never an answer to it. And people who don't like women, people who don't like young women, people who don't like Greens. It was just like everybody. And then it was also, it was very, it was orchestrated in a systematic way in one respect, because it was lobbyists and PR people, like Matt Hooton and lobby groups who work with the government. I had one woman apologise to me a few weeks after I'd first gone on Twitter, because we were on a political panel together and she was representing the National Party's view, and she was a head of a PR or lobby group, and she sort of, the first thing she said to me, because I was being just, friendly, sitting next to someone, and she sort of said, "I'm so sorry about all that stuff on Twitter." Then I had to go and look up who she was and what she'd actually done, what she'd said, and she'd tried to dig into me about being on the North and South cover. She was like, "How can you say you're a serious politician if you're wearing a dress and sitting on the floor on it?" And she'd kind of gone off, and I had a really ready-made response to that, which is that, well, the patriarchy told me to be shapeless and colourless and sexless in the Middle East, so don't you tell me, how a woman gets to look. And that was fine, but it hadn't clicked with me that these were actually lobbyists, that there is this aspect now to our political system that's playing out on social media where people get to just look like individuals out in the public. Whereas when they're on RNZ or whatever, they have to say, full disclosure, I represent the ACT Party or whatever it is, which I've heard Matthew Hooton do. But when they're on social media, you don't know who is employed by who's saying this because they're supporting their employer, Anyway, so that did happen, but you can just switch it off.
Okay, I've got 7 questions to end with, and we've got 5 minutes to get through them all. So,
go.
Do you have a go-to definition of sustainability?
What I hate is the Brexit model of, using the word sustainability to do with immigration, which was just exclusionary. Go-to definition of sustainability? No. I think I go environmental and social, social justice measures are intrinsically linked, and so we need to kind of sustain humans at the same time as we sustain the environment. But beyond that, I'll work on it.
What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
The biggest success I've had is probably establishing my little community that I was talking about and sort of feeling at home again in New Zealand among engaged sort of activist people.
We're writing a book of these interviews. We're calling it Tomorrow's Heroes. What is your superpower?
My superpower is making an argument. Persuasion, hopefully.
You might have just answered this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Yes. Activism is certainly the rent that we pay for living on this planet.
As a lawyer, aren't you supposed to be objective or something?
Yes, but being objective and being able to use logic to make argument means that you can actually be very creative. You need to be able to argue both points and so understand all sides of stories. It's about empathy.
How much money would it take for you to not turn down a client from someone you disagreed with, smoking lobby or something, or whatever it is that you would disagree with?
I don't think, as a lawyer, I don't have any problem saying you actually don't get to disagree with the person, because it's all about the justice process and it's about representing that person fairly. So I have complete confidence in that system. As long as we all work ethically within that system, that's fine. So you're only putting forward the argument as far as it can go in that system. You're never ever saying my client is right and hiding the truth. So it's absolutely fine. It's a myth that you can't represent someone that, is a tobacco lobbyist. I wouldn't be a tobacco lobbyist. That's a different story.
What challenges are you looking forward to in the next couple of years? There's an obvious one coming up in how many days you said it was.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully Parliament and seeing what that looks like and seeing what persuasion looks like in a House as fraught as that.
What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
Justice.
That's enough to work every day?
Yeah, I think I'm one of those people that gets really, really deeply annoyed by injustice, so I can't let it go. So I think it's almost selfish in that way.
But you can't fix everything.
No, but as long as you're involved, really, really involved in solving one thing, I think you can kind of be calm and you can, you know, you can understand and really appreciate and respect the others that are working on the other things.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur, what would you have happen?
I think I would probably go global for this. So I think for me, because I've seen the world without it, it would be about democracy. I think it would be about giving that dignity to all people. And I think the other stuff will follow. I think that's the only way we can be sustainable is through self-determination.
Is that the dignity of democracy or the dignity that democracy brings?
Well, being able to participate in the system that governs you gives you dignity. And it means that, for example, environmental activists aren't shot to death by, you know, governments, because governments are responsible to the people.
And lastly, in 30 seconds, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Please vote. Not everyone can.
Thank you. You've been listening to Sustainable Lands on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM. The show was recorded on the 28th of July, 2017. Our guest was Golriz Garaman. Your host, Professor Samuel Mann, and me, Shane Gallagher. You can get podcasts of previous shows at sustainablelands.org, where you can subscribe on iTunes or on oir.org.nz. We hope you enjoyed the show.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.